Welcome. Good morning, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is October 10, 2020. This is the third of three cases on our calendar this morning for oral argument. I ask you all again to adhere to the guidelines that our monitor has indicated already. Make sure that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal will show a running clock. Each party will have 15 minutes for their argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Keep an eye on that clock as well. Please identify yourself before you begin your argument, and with that, the appellant may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Hunt. I am the attorney for the appellant, Nicholas James Kyle, the father and legal custodian of the respective minor children that are subject to this matter. Today, we are here on appeal from a district court order which denied Mr. Kyle's private petition for the termination of Ms. Munnins' parental rights for both minor children. The questions before the court essentially that the appellant points out is whether the district court erred in failing to terminate mother's parental rights under the circumstances. We have filed about a 50-page brief in support of this appeal. But in the present case, this involves two minor children, ages 12 and 9. One of the minor children, the oldest minor child, is not the biological child of my client, the appellant. The youngest minor child is biologically my client's child. That is important for reasons set forth in the brief, but as I will talk about at a later time in this oral argument. At the district court level, the court found pursuant to 260C, 301, appellant met his required burden to prove at least one of the factors which would allow for the termination of the parental rights of Ms. Munnins. Notwithstanding that finding that the burden was met by clear and convincing evidence, the court denied the termination, essentially stating that it was not in the best interest of the minor children to terminate the parental rights at this time. Historically, in this matter, Ms. Munnins has not been involved in the children's lives since approximately 2014. That is undisputed. The youngest child essentially has not been in her mother's care since she was approximately 10 months old. This litigation has been going on for a long time, almost a decade. And under the circumstances, my client brought a private petition for the termination of parental rights based upon the requisite statute and the allowance for such, and there was no county involvement in that petition. At the district court, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not there needed to be reasonable efforts to reunify Ms. Munnins with the minor children, but the court did correctly determine that that was not a requirement under the statute because Mr. Kyle was not requesting that the court look at the presumption of abandonment. So getting to the position of the appellant is that the district court erred in multiple different ways in evaluating the evidence and in the conclusions that the court came up with, particularly as it pertains to the fact that the court found that one of the factors had been met for termination of parental rights, that being non-payment of child support, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, failing to financially support the child. However, in its analysis, the court stated essentially that notwithstanding that the parental rights should not be terminated because of essentially one reason cited by the court, that Ms. Munnins may sometime in the future when her other non-joint child reaches school age, potentially in the next 3 to 4 years, she may continue to pay child support. Purely speculation by the district court.
Counsel?
Yes?
Going into those findings that you're referencing by the district court, it appears to me in paragraph 61 that the court is suggesting that the mother will, first off, it observes that the mother did make child support payments in full when she was working. And then it goes on to suggest, as you have just said, that once the youngest child's in school, she'll continue to work and make child support payments. So I think, although the court found the grounds, as you say, in paragraph 37 and 38, for failure to pay, it also then turned around and said, based on past behavior, based on what is reasonable to assume will be future behavior, I find it in the best interest of the children not to use that as grounds to terminate. You agree?
I agree, except for where we have an issue is the evidence didn't suggest that. The court did find that Ms. Monins was not paying and was not paying without cause. That otherwise, without cause, then we would not have met the first factor. The court essentially went on to speculate that maybe, even though she had a child support obligation dating years before this, she was $34,000 behind on child support, and in her own testimony testified that essentially it wasn't worth it to work to pay child support because of daycare expenses. Now, the district court does find that potentially, speculatively, sometime in the future, she might pay. But that was based upon essentially 1 year of payment of child support. And in fact, the record reflects that it wasn't in full during that period of time. And so our position is that the court erred in making that determination because there was no evidence to suggest at any time, no credible evidence to suggest at any time that she would actually be employed sometime in the near future. I refer to the case that we cited in our brief had some, and I don't have that right offhand, but it's in our brief that the to find that at some point in the future, but not in the near future, that a obligor might pay child support at some point would completely strip the need for that provision in the termination of parental rights statute. The issue is that the court essentially made a finding that it's not in the best interest of the children, but didn't base it upon, from what I read, base it upon the fact that she might pay in the future. It was more related to the speculative opinion that the children might have a relationship with mom in the future and that the financial piece doesn't matter. So our argument is that was essentially an error in the application of the law, because under the case law, courts have found to not terminate based upon that provision in the statute if there is an actual reasonable showing that the parent will, in the very near future, participate and financially support the child. So that was that's essentially where in that paragraph, the court goes on to say essentially that the child, that she might pay in the future, but that's no different than speculating about the relationship that she may have in the future. And so our position is that was error.
Mr. Hunt, could you please review for me? I don't recall now, it's a long order, of course. I don't recall now any discussion by the district court of the consequences of her failure to pay child support. In other words, whether that left the children in a different or substantially different position than they would have been looking backward and looking forward. Did the district court make findings or engage in a discussion about that? And also, I'm kind of wondering what the state of the evidence is on that.
Your Honor, there wasn't any evidence essentially presented that would have stated one way or the other, frankly. I don't believe there was much evidence, frankly, presented in regard to that. My client has been the sole bearer of all financial responsibility for these children. And the state of the evidence was probably, it just wasn't there as far as, hardship or something of that nature. My client has made it work. I think he testified that he's been taking care of the children solely, and there's been no financial contribution except for that 1 year during that 9 year period.
So I'm wondering whether, to the extent that she has failed to pay child support, I can imagine that had the consequence, perhaps, just in a simply zero sum way, that then he had to increase his contributions toward the child, toward the child's needs. Now, it's also possible, conceivably, that he was unable to do so, and therefore expenses were not incurred, and to the children's detriment. Can you tell me, in a nutshell, was it one or the other of those, or somewhere in between?
Mr. Kyle had taken on the 100% cost and financial responsibility for the children, including their therapeutic costs, that he put them into therapy, largely because of the circumstances that were created by Ms. Monitz. He has a large familial support. His family has supported him throughout this process. But yes, he is the one who had to step up and take all financial responsibility for the minor children throughout this process. I can say they haven't gone without. He's a very hardworking person. I think the court made those findings, actually, particularly in the amended order that the court issued, congratulating and thanking Mr. Kyle for being such a good providing parent of the minor children. And so with that said, I can't represent that there's been a circumstance where the children have gone without due to Ms. Monin's failure to support the minor children.
And doesn't that then indicate that in the future that the children will not suffer from any of her future non-payment of child support? And doesn't that go to the issue of best interest and in a way that tends to support the district court's findings and conclusions?
I don't necessarily agree. I think the issue is the statute itself and the wording. She has an obligation. The children could have had more an opportunity to save for college, for instance. Even if my client was the wealthiest person in the world, that doesn't negate her responsibility. And so if you look at the best interests of the children, it's obviously a balancing act. And what essentially is happening is the district court is weighing the competing interests, which under the state of Minnesota, you have to weigh the competing interests of the parties, the children. And if there's a competing interest between the parties and the children, it goes to the children. The best interest of the child is paramount. For mom to shirk on her responsibilities, and we've proven by clear and convincing evidence without cause, then if you go to the next analysis of the best interest of the children, certainly you have to weigh the competing interests, certainly by having more contribution financially from mother, that they would have more opportunity. It's not to say that they're living some sort of lavish lifestyle, but certainly my client having the full responsibility is detrimental to the children if mom is not contributing. And so that's the position that we have, is we meet the obligations under the statute. In the district court's analysis, it's simply a speculative opinion that she might pay in the future based upon 1 year over the course of 9 that she's paid child support. And by Ms. Munnan's own testimony, she stated she has no intention of doing this until her other child goes to school. And so to find otherwise, I think completely would strip the meaning behind the statute that says you need to pay support. And if you don't do so without cause, and you can prove that by clear and convincing evidence and prove that it's in the best interest of the child for a termination, you might as well remove that provision from the statute if we don't follow that statute.
Well, they're independent requirements, right? I mean, first is that one of the statutory grounds must be satisfied. Secondly, termination must be in the best interest of the children. So I mean, your argument almost, it sounds like you're urging us to say that satisfying the first necessarily satisfies the second.
No, Your Honor, I want to be really clear. That isn't our position. That when you weigh the entire circumstances, we were talking about the one financial aspect of this, but the only issue that the court talked about as it pertains to the financial aspect was what in that small, very small paragraph. If you weigh the entirety of the best interest of the child, of the children, and you give essentially the competing interest, the paramount interest is the best interest of the children. If you weigh all of the factors, all of the evidence of Dina McMahon, for example, if you weigh all of that, which the court did not do, then we believe that the court erred in stating that termination was not in the best interest of the children.
The district court devoted several pages to its discussion of best interests, and I believe that it discussed a lot of issues or sub issues other than the financial issues. You know, for example, the mother making improvements in her deficiencies, the children wish to maintain a strong desire to have a relationship with her, and other factors. It seems to me that the district court's best interest analysis was appropriately considered many different factors that go into the children's best interest, not just mom's future likelihood of paying child support.
I believe my time is up.
Go ahead, counsel.
Okay,
you may answer.
Well, I would disagree based upon the evidence that was presented. For instance, there was an analysis, but it disregarded certain things like the expert witness who testified about what's in the best interest of the children and the circumstances as a whole. Even given the opportunity to the district court to remedy the issue of disregarding Ms. McMahon's testimony, the district court said in the amended order on page 6 of the amended order that she did not ignore the assertion or the opinions of Ms. McMahon in the family, but she was going to intend to analyze Ms. McMahon's opinions in the family law file. And granted, this was a consolidated trial, but Ms. McMahon was testifying based upon her expert testimony, which was stipulated to. And the court, even in its amended order, states that it did not analyze her opinions. The court took a few statements of Ms. McMahon essentially out of context and then stated that Ms. McMahon was making therapy recommendations, which, as we provided in our brief, was not her ultimate opinion. And she states exactly why. And she's an expert in this area. And so the concern is the balancing test of all of these issues. We met one factor, then it moves to the best interest factors and the best interest of the child factors under the 260C statute. And in its analysis, the court says, well, there are these things that the court, based upon its discretion, I understand, believes that the mother in this case did some things between 2018 and 19 to get some therapy. But if the Court of Appeals, Your Honors, look at the evidence, you'll see that this was all self, the evidence itself is very concerning. The district court gave no analysis to Ms. McMahon's testimony and essentially did not look at all of the evidence in a vacuum and in weighing the best interest of the children. One very concerning—
Counsel, I think you've answered the question.
Okay. Thank you.
Judge Johnson, anything else? Nope. All right, thank you very much. Your time has expired. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Counsel, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Geis, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Laura Munnens. It seems to me that terminating a parent's parental rights based on non-payment of child support would result in a slippery slope. Just an aside, I have the good fortune of being court-appointed counsel for parents who are in contempt actions for the non-payment of child support. If termination of parental rights were allowed on this ground and this ground alone, I cannot imagine the number of cases that would be brought by private action for the termination of parental rights. My client presently finds herself in a situation whereby paying child support is not practicable. She lives in a rural area with little population, without the benefit of a driver's license, and at the same time is caring for a 2.5-year-old child of her own. Now, it's interesting to note that never has child protection been brought in for her 2.5-year-old child. She is a fit and proper parent. My client endeavors to get her driver's license back in the near future so as to enable employment opportunities and the payment of child support.
Also, on that issue, did she lose her license because of the lack of child support? Is this kind of a circular issue?
It may well be, Your Honor, and that is one of the downsides of child support actions, is that there are only so many remedies available, which could ultimately result in incarceration for periods of time, but it could be the loss of one's license, as it is here. It could also result in the loss of one's professional license. But yes, Your Honor, and it is a circular problem. My client is doing the best she can with what she has. And the most operative word in the termination statute is the word may. Yes, the district court found that my client was non-compliant with her child support obligation. But a finding of any one of the grounds for termination is subject to may, and that rests upon the district court. Therein lies the second prong. If the threshold is met, whether the termination is in the child's best interest. Now, the presiding judge herein at the district court level had the good fortune of overseeing the many years of this case's development. And the presiding judge, of course, was privy to the testimony given at trial herein on each of the multiple occasions. Her Honor handsome, determined that, yes, the child support obligation was not being attended to by my client, but that it was not in the children's best interest to terminate her rights for that reason alone. Of course, Her Honor Hansen did not find that the other grounds upon which the appellant attempted to terminate my client's rights were found statutorily based upon the totality of the evidence and testimony. Certainly, the evidence adduced at trial demonstrated that the children herein are not in a financial hardship type of situation. All of their needs are being met, and that was testified to by appellants and certainly unrefuted. As a practical consideration, should the court terminate my client's parental rights, a collateral consequence would be the 2.5-year-old child that my client has been properly raising since birth. Because once one's parental rights are terminated, that parent or those parents are given the label of being palpably unfit to parent. Certainly, my client is not palpably unfit, and the district court so stated in the multiple orders that were issued. My client did not abandon her children. Yes, it has been years of district court actions, which demonstrates that my client never gave up on her children, that she was desirous, as she is today, to remaining a part of the children's lives. In fact, it wasn't until after my client filed a motion for phased in parenting time that appellant filed a petition to then terminate her rights.
Mr. Geis?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could respond directly to opposing counsel's argument. And I'm referring to his argument where he criticizes the district court's reasoning with respect to best interests. And I think specifically it's focus on her ability to pay child support in the future. Can you comment on that, whether the district court erred in that analysis?
Your Honor, I do not believe even an iota that the district court erred in its determination that it is in the child's best interest that the parental rights of my client not be terminated based upon the non-compliance with child support. The court, not just in one order or document, but in multiple orders following the trial herein, methodically went through the best interest factors as they apply to the best interests of a child. I think the court, the district court, left no doubt that terminating my client's parental rights would not be in the children's best interest. Now, I know that Attorney Hunt brought up testimony by their expert, Dina McMahon. And what Attorney Hunt failed to mention is that during the testimony adduced at trial, their expert, Ms. McMahon, made it clear that she did not understand or comprehend or appreciate the ramifications of a termination of parental rights. She thought that terminating my client's parental rights would allow for my client to remain in contact with the children and to build a relationship. While she is indeed an expert in her field, she demonstrated at court that she was not attuned to the consequences of a termination of parental rights. And I find it very telling that appellant's expert never interviewed my client. They did not meet until the day that Ms. McMahon arrived to testify. Certainly, she conducted document review. She conducted interviews of the children in the presence of Attorney Hunt's client and his girlfriend or fiance, but never once was my client contacted by Ms. McMahon for an interview or a child parent observation. So I find that Ms. McMahon's arguments are wholly one-sided, and by virtue of the fact that she did not understand, had no comprehension of the ramifications of a termination of parental rights, I believe that the court assigned her testimony its due weight based upon the credibility of statements made by Ms. McMahon at trial. Your Honor, given the fact that Her Honor Hansen presided over this matter for the entirety of the years in the past, that she observed my client firsthand in the improvements that she made, these were all considerations that only a district court judge in such a position could have made prior to issuing the order. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? I'm just going to remind you, thank you very much. Mr. Hunt, go ahead, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address where Mr. Geis left off and the idea that Ms. McMahon didn't understand the ramifications of a termination is just, it's not correct. The testimony of Ms. McMahon will flesh that out for Your Honors when reviewing the the entire transcript. But Ms. McMahon's point was lost on the court, it apparently, because of what we've shown in our brief. And what Ms. McMahon testified about was the idea that these children, they will always have their mother in their life because they know about her. My client hasn't, you know, completely cut her off in any way. She cut herself off. And she said, Ms. McMahon will always have an opportunity, or I'm sorry, Ms. Munnins would have an opportunity to see the children because she believed, based on past actions by my client, that my client would potentially foster and encourage a relationship down the road once the children have done what they need to through therapy to rectify the harm that was created by Ms. Munnins, the harm that Ms. Munnins agrees she created. And so that was the context. And so to imply that Ms. McMahon doesn't understand the ramifications, given her expert testimony and her resume, it's in and of itself, it just isn't accurate. The other interesting aspect of what Mr. Geis brought up is that Ms. McMahon did not interview Ms. Munnins, but frankly, neither did the guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem never spoke to anybody. She didn't do any sort of independent investigation, but yet the court weighed her testimony. The guardian ad litem admitted that she reviewed the best interest factors in a family court file, but not until day four of the trial did either the guardian ad litem or even the district court realize that we were actually having to analyze the best interest factors under 260C. That was on the fourth day of trial. And the record is it shows that. So to say that Ms. McMahon's testimony should not be given more weight as an expert, but yet to weigh the guardian ad litem's testimony in such a way as to believe her recommendations, we think is clear error. She didn't interview Ms. Munnins. Nobody went to Ms. Munnins' home. Nobody determined it by an independent investigation, which is generally required by the guardian ad litem statute in a termination matter to conduct it an independent investigation to determine the veracity of whether or not Ms. Munnins is caring for this other child in an appropriate way. In looking at the argument that this would somehow create a slippery slope if parties who were without cause not paying child support would have their parental rights terminated, it just flies in the face of why the legislature would have such a thing in a statute. That statute does not say that there has to be a detrimental effect on the children in order to find that a parent hasn't contributed without cause. Yes, there needs to be the second analysis of the best interest factors, but 260C 301 subdivision 1B3 is very, very clear. And the court has the authority to do that if it determines that that factor is met by clear and convincing evidence, and it only needs one, and subsequently, it's in the best interest of the children for the termination, weighing those three factors, the parents, the child, and then if there's the competing interest. The fact of the matter is the record has nothing in it, essentially, that states that McKenna, the youngest child, has any relationship whatsoever with mom, nor does she have any desire to have a relationship with mom. So the court's lumping it all into one, lumping both children into one, saying that they both want to have a relationship with mom is not accurate under the circumstances.
Mr. Hunt?
Yes.
Going back to your argument about the statute, subdivision 1B3, frankly, I'm not very familiar with that clause. I don't think that we see it come to this court very often. Is there precedent for termination under that ground? I mean, in other words, is there either published authority or unpublished cases where district courts have found that that ground has been satisfied and then gone forward all the way to termination?
Yes, Your Honor. And we have cited that in our brief.
And which cases are they? Just case
names. I'm looking. Uh, I apologize, I'm looking here. It's a 1994 decision, I recall that, Your Honor. I apologize, I don't have that right in front of me at this time. If I can find it here. Okay, we have the, we have in re the matter of the parent of MG and JG. It's 375 Northwest 2nd 588. It's a 1985 case. There's in re the matter of the welfare of JDL, AKA JDE, 522 Northwest 2nd 364. It's a Minnesota Court of Appeals case in 1994. In that case, they did terminate based upon this provision.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. This matter will be taken under advisement and we will issue a decision within the next 90. Is it a 90 day? Within the statutory time period. Thank you very much. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you very much. This concludes our calendar for the morning and we are adjourned.